7:07. Do sex change operations work? Some who've been through them say it's the only solution for them. But one feminist campaigner claims sex reassignment surgery is based on unscientific ideas and could be doing more harm than good. She's here, Julie Bindle. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And in Manchester is Steve Whittle, who's had female-to-male surgery. He's a professor of law at Manchester Metropolitan University and founded the transgender pressure group Press for Change. Steve, morning to you.
Good morning.
Julie, explain broadly why you are opposed to sex change operations taking place.
Well, I think that we're applying a surgical solution to what's essentially a psychological issue. And that's not to say that people who desire sex change surgery are mad, mentally ill, but actually they're in great distress and often railroaded into behaving in a particular way that befits old-fashioned notions of gender. For example, in the 1950s, when this diagnosis was invented by very traditional psychiatrists, male psychiatrists, women were women and men were men. And, you know, we lived in extremely polarised gender roles. Women with their, you know, baking muffins and prancing around, drinking coffee with their female friends, wearing high heels. And men, of course, who were the breadwinners, the masculine head of the family. And I think that that's how it evolved, that psychiatrists would assess a person who was perhaps a man, who was effeminate, hated his body, perhaps through sexual abuse, perhaps for other reasons, and decided that he would fit more comfortably being a woman. Because, of course, often we want to escape the pressures of who we are, what we are, and our past. And so it was developed as a way, almost as an aversion therapy, in a way that certainly at the time homosexuality was seen as a mental illness that you could be cured from with electric shock surgery,
treatment,
etc. And so I just want to step back and look at why we accept it as a diagnosis, and is it really a solution to carve up healthy people's bodies, parts of people's bodies, in order to make them fit with a very old-fashioned notion of what it is to be a man or a woman.
And you've come to this conclusion from what, reviewing case studies or talking to transsexuals? How?
I don't think it's that I've come to a conclusion, and certainly I haven't done any academic or otherwise study on this. I've looked at what it means to be a man and a woman for a very long time. You know, as a feminist, as a lesbian, as someone who has lived outside of my prescribed gender role, you know, since I was a teenager, as someone who does not fit with the stereotype of what a real woman should be, I think that we should allow people to live in whatever way they wish in their bodies. And if you're born female, if you're born male, you should actually be able to move outside of those prescribed roles.
Mm. And so I think without having an operation to change
without
your
surgery
genitals.
Well, obviously, I mean, the argument is for many people who identify as transsexual that they feel if they don't have the surgery, they will have to commit suicide, they will die. It's the worst thing they can possibly imagine, being trapped in this body. But we need to look at what that's about, because actually, if we got rid of gender, if we were just able to live as people, yes, of course, our biological sex is important for creation, etc. But if we were to look at how we can live simply as people, then would we really put so much emphasis on our genitals, what they look like, and the fact that they're attached to us or not? I don't think we would.
But I'm assuming that alongside what you're saying, you respect the right of those who want this kind of surgery to have it.
It's not up to me to say anyone does not have the right to have any surgical procedure performed on them that they can either afford or that they can get through the National Health Service. My concern is that psychiatrists have never really properly evaluated this diagnosis. Remember, it's a 1950s diagnosis, and I think there's been very little progression in terms of the way that psychiatrists view this. And certainly, if people know it's an option to have the surgery, they're far more likely to try to go down that route, particularly with all the support groups available for people who identify as transsexual, than look at a talking solution, some other kind of solution that doesn't involve surgery. So I'm just asking us to stand back and reevaluate and look at this, not from a right-wing moralist Christian perspective, because there are some deeply transphobic people who treat anyone who identifies as transsexual appallingly. What I'm talking about is not discriminating against individuals, but looking at the entire industry and what it's about.
Okay, Steve Whittle, had female to male surgery. Has Julie Bindle made a reasoned argument for standing back and looking at this whole area?
I'm also standing back and looking at this area. I think it's absolutely imperative that we continue to investigate why people feel like this constantly, because one day there might be the happy pill. And if the happy pill was there, would I have taken it all those years ago? I often debate that question. And maybe, you know, I lived for a long time as, well, for a short time as a sort of butch lesbian teenager, and, you know, despite the rigours of the 1970s, survived moderately well like that. But at the end of the day, it wasn't me. Now, clearly, I'm an example of somebody who's not mad in their day-to-day life. You know, I've got a family, I've got kids who are raised beautifully, I have a really good job. But I do admit that I may have one problem that, you know, is significant, and maybe other people might call it mad, and that was, you know, just like other, many other trans people, as a teenager, as a young person, I was desperate not to have the body I had. I never wanted to grow up to be a woman. I didn't want to grow up to be somebody's lesbian partner, never mind somebody's wife. And I could not imagine a place for me at all in this world.
Can I ask you this question? Is it possible to live as a member of the opposite sex without having a sex change operation?
Well, I have done lots of academic studies, and I've heard the tales of many, many transsexual people. And repeatedly they talk about their attempted suicides before having access to treatment, and of how happy they are in their lives afterwards. Now, I'm not saying that we should cut healthy parts off people's bodies, but if it ultimately ensures that they go on to live, at the moment, successful, productive lives, then that is the solution.
But then presumably you've also met people who've regretted that operation after it's been done.
Well, like Julie, I've met the odd one, and certainly I met somebody back in the 1990s who had reverted from living as a woman to living back as a man and was having an extremely troubled time. But the problem was that they, you know, had access to the wrong sort of person, had been given access to treatment too quickly. And, I mean, that's certainly one thing I have learned. If people access treatment, particularly surgery, too quickly, then they are invariably the people who are very unhappy.
I mean, presumably, one has to live in one's new role before surgery is allowed to take place.
Well, technically, you should live for 1 year, and most NHS facilities make you live for a damn sight longer than that in your new role. The trouble is, we have always had in this world rogue doctors and money. You know, nowadays you can buy gender reassignment surgery from male to female for the price of a high-quality car loan. And that to me is really problematic. I'm absolutely for ensuring that we regulate this industry. But I also accept, and certainly for myself, that this was the only answer.
Yes. But do you accept, as Julie was saying, that some people might be railroaded into this kind of...
I do indeed accept that some people might be railroaded. But I hope that the physicians and doctors who are involved in the International Association for Transgender Health are those people who think about this very carefully all the time. They do research, they continue that throughout their lives, and they take new looks constantly at what's happening.
There's an awful lot, though, Stephen, and I know you and I agree on this. Well, whether or not we agree on this being an awful lot, I don't know, but there are some psychiatrists who do not take the proper care to discuss with that person their life previous to them deciding that they were transsexual, and what the options are for them living in a new role. And certainly, you know, there's been a recent case where it was heard that one particular psychiatrist regularly took only 45 minutes to an hour to confirm the diagnosis of his patients, give them irreversible hormone treatment that day, and then, you know, fairly quickly they were under the surgeon's knife. And this is what concerns me.
But what would be the motivation for a psychiatrist to whisk through the diagnosis and handing out the hormone treatment?
I think there can be two. One, of course, can be money. There's an awful lot of money to be made out of this business. And of course, the NHS is one particular story, but doctors who run a private practice also can make an awful lot of money from this. But also, I think that for many of the psychiatrists, because psychiatry is quite a traditional profession, they do not really question the basis of the diagnosis. And as soon as, for example, a man will go to see one who agrees that, yes, they did always play with toys when they were children and preferred the company of girls and feel trapped in the wrong body, then those boxes are ticked and they're given hormones. I saw one documentary which was deeply troubling, which dealt with female-to-male transsexual people, where a doctor, a psychiatrist, a clinician, when he had agreed to give hormones to and refer surgery for one particular young woman, gave her the leaflet about how testosterone will affect her. She had never seen that leaflet before. She was about to actually start the treatment that day. Mm. She sat at his desk in that appointment reading the leaflet, and I think that's absolutely outrageous.
Well,
what
fortunately, what we are in the process of actually almost reaching the final stage of is new protocols for treatment here in the UK. And there are international protocols, but as Julie knows, unfortunately, medicine is a world where people have pound signs in their eyes often. I personally am very much of the view that caution should be taken. I'm very much of the view that we really should facilitate the offering of group and talking therapies to people undergoing this.
Okay, we'll talk more.
But I'm also very aware that for many people, this is the answer at the moment.
Let's talk more in a moment, and we'll talk to our listeners who've called us as well, who are hearing what Julie Bindle is saying, and also Steve Whittle from the Manchester Metropolitan University, Professor of Law, and also founded the transgender pressure group Press for Change. 0500 909 693 is our phone number. It's free to call if you want to join in the conversation. Here are some emails from you on the subject of transsexuals and sex change operations. Julian in Leicester says, I find the pseudo-medical idea that a man or woman can be born in the wrong body, thus legitimising a so-called sex change operation, extremely tenuous. The interesting fact that arises from these cases is that there are apparently so many more male-to-female operations taking place than female-to-male. How do the doctors explain this? What seems most probable is that the preponderance of male-to-female sex change operations that take place is in direct relation to the crisis in male identity and masculinity that has occurred over the last 30 years in response to feminism. Julie, would you like to comment on that?
Well, you know, I've been hearing for the last 30 years that masculinity is in crisis, and I have yet to see the fallout of this crisis. I think that certainly there is a definite pressure on men as well as women to live in very prescribed gender roles. See, one of the problems I have with the diagnosis of transsexualism is that as a feminist, I actually want to do away with gender, and I don't want to...
Are you sure it's just not about stopping women becoming men?
Stopping women becoming men?
In terms of sex change operations.
Oh, I see. No, I think that probably there's nothing as conspiratorial as that. I think that it's simply this. We do live in rigid, prescribed rules in terms of how we behave as men and women. And until we eradicate that, and as a feminist, that, of course, is my end goal, then we're always going to have people feeling that they're behaving in a way that doesn't fit with their body. I mean, I don't behave in a way that fits with my body. I don't wear makeup. I'm a lesbian. I've never wanted children. And certainly, you know, I would fight with men if I had to defend myself. And so in a sense, you know, I'm not a real woman. But when you go along, if a transsexual person goes along to a clinic to say that they want to change sex, because you can't change gender, gender's just learnt, then what happens is they're given lessons often in ways that they behave in a traditional sense. So in fact, I could do with going along to a gender reassignment clinic in a way to show me how to be a real woman, to show me how to defer to men, to show me how to walk properly in high heels, how to cross my ankle, how to...
But I mean, I know you're being slightly flippant there to prove a point, but do you think it's relevant even today in 2007 that we are pressured to behave in particular ways because either you're a man or a woman?
Absolutely, of course we are, and that's the whole basis of
Give me an example.
Well, it's seen as quite shocking, for example, if women sit with their legs sprawled open, drinking a can of Red Stripe on the tube going to work in the morning. If we actually saw a man doing that, we wouldn't really look twice, would we? Now, that's a crude example of that. But also, if you think about the way that we're supposed to behave in our general lives, the ideal is that we are, of course, heterosexual, that we, of course, want children and that we have children, that we do, when we go out to a function, to an event, wear makeup, that we don't slob around in trainers and jeans, that we actually wear proper women's shoes, and that somehow we do something with our hair that makes us distinct from men.
Okay, let's hear what our listeners say. Hi, Andy and Tamworth, how are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm listening to your guest speaker there. She doesn't want to give anybody labels, you know. Men and women should be just called people, but she seems happy enough labelling herself, and she's done so 3 or 4 times in the last 5 minutes as a feminist lesbian. Mm. Now, that's a label to me. That's someone loud and proud, flying the flag. This is what I am. Look at me. You know, the fact is, she's a woman. End of story. I'm a man. You know, I mean, the only label I ever want is man or born as seen.
I actually didn't mention labels. I was talking about roles, and for me, it's important that, as a feminist, I identify, obviously, as a woman, because as a woman, I'm trying to fight the oppression from men, which hopefully one day will be eradicated, and we can all get on extremely well.
Hang on, Andy.
Say again. What did you say, Andy?
I said she's not being oppressed. I just don't believe that she's being oppressed.
Who is oppressing you, Julie?
Well, I'm not actually sitting here being oppressed. I'm having a very nice time. But in general, you know, there is irrefutable evidence that men do oppress women in general terms. For example, if you look at the fact that 1 in 3 women at any one time in their lives will suffer a sexual assault or an attempted sexual assault, 1 in 4 women will experience domestic violence, child sexual abuse is endemic, rape convictions are falling and yet reports of rape are increasing. We all women know, and we can lie, we can pretend, but we know that either we've experienced a sexual assault at one stage in our lives, or we fear it. And so, of course, there's oppression. We still don't get equal pay. We still haven't got any of the equality wrapped up tightly that we asked for in the 1970s. So you can't pretend that there's no such thing as inequality between men and women, because that's just naive.
Well, my last boss was a woman, and she sacked me. Laid me off.
Well, we can all think about individual examples. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Well, you're clouding things with statistics. Do you know what I mean?
Why am I clouding it? I thought that was clarifying it. I'm trying to actually give you some concrete examples of how women are unequal.
I want to bring in Alison.
Statistics just clouds it. It doesn't clarify anything. You can make anything up with statistics.
Andy,
you know?
Many thanks for that. Alison, good morning to you.
Hi there.
Alison, am I right in thinking that you are a man in the process of going through...
that's right.
In the process of becoming a woman, is that correct?
Yeah.
Right, okay. So what about the discussion we're having this morning? What is your view?
Well, there's various views on it. It's not always necessary to have an operation at the end or at some point in the change. You know, I think that possibly some men desire that and need it. Others can possibly live without it. To some, it's just a cosmetic thing.
Mm-hmm.
At present with me, it's not totally necessary but I might change my mind in a year or 18 months' time.
Mm-hmm. And why do you feel that you need to become a woman?
I've desired it all my life, but society and conventions and everything has meant that this has to be kept under wraps, and I know a number of transsexual people that are just like that, that modern society and the internet has really brought them out in terms of being able to live a new life, and several that were on the verge of suicide and really depressed can at last find a sort of salvation because they found that this is what the problem was.
Mm. And have you come under any pressure from anybody, whether it's medical or family
to have
the operation?
Sorry?
To have an operation?
No, that's all been completely, will be completely my own decision as to whether I do that or not.
Mm. Thank you very much, Alison. Hello, Pete in Coventry.
Morning. How
Morning.
Are you?
Very well, thank you. Yes.
It's just a quick point. I met a couple of years ago and actually employed someone who'd had full transgender realignment. She used to be a man. She was then a woman. And she basically lived all her life, her family and everyone else. She had two grown-up sons, and she was married. But this person was one of the most wonderful people I've met. She was completely happy with who she'd become, and was very content, and used to talk about her friends who she'd met with, who had the same issues, who felt the same. You know, she had a completely rounded personality. And I think, we can't stop people having access to that surgery based on what I probably believe the minority of people who might not be suitable for it.
Thank you very much, Pete. Duffy's email, how can a person possibly know that changing gender will solve whatever problems they're experiencing? Steve?
Hi, well, I agree entirely. I'm very sympathetic to the viewpoints that Julie has made, and particularly in relation to the experience of women with regard to oppression. You know, I'm an academic. I've worked as a feminist academic for years. I see all those things. But the fact is that we still are left with a situation that many, many people at the moment feel very unfulfilled in who they are. We're not talking about gender roles here. I've met many transsexual people who seem to fly at the complete odds to what might be considered conventional gender roles for women and for men. I've also met many people who were treated in the 50s and 60s who were obliged then to stick to very conservative positions. And that I have no doubt about, that historically this treatment was done in a way in which it enforced very rigid gender stereotypes. But I certainly don't think that's the case now. And certainly we have a new generation of treating doctors who, many of them are actually lesbian or gay or even trans themselves. They know what it's like to be at odds with society, and they know what it's like to try and resolve those issues. Many of them would be the first to say, you know, it doesn't take surgery to make a man or a woman. And for many trans people, surgery is not the be-all and end-all. And I personally am all for waiting to ensure that surgery is the right thing for people.
Okay.
But when it comes down to core issues, how do we relate with people? What is it that people see when they relate to? It's not our genitals at all. And for many trans people, it will not be that they ever look like ordinary men or ordinary women, though some do. They will always be seen as trans people, and you get people like me who've chosen not to hide in the closet and are out there, even though I could pass just as an ordinary guy. Mm-hmm. I'm out there as a trans man who was a former lesbian feminist. I'm interested, and many of the trans community are really interested in changing gender stereotypes, but until somebody produces that happy pill that means that you are suddenly comfortable with a body which you have felt completely alien with before, we're going to continue to have people who want gender reassignment. And should those people be refused that, should they be refused that and forced to live miserable lives when nobody has ever found an alternative solution? Psychotherapy has been tried, psychiatry has been tried, every possibility and every single case that's recorded of those attempts being made has failed.
Okay, thank you very much, Steve Whittle. Thanks for coming on the programme. Julie Bindle, thank you to you as well.